Thanks, Lily. Hi, everybody. My name's John Haley. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here, and I want to first thank Jim and Brenda for their talks at the beginning of the meeting, and I want to welcome everybody that's a newcomer. I'd also like to encourage you, if you're new, to keep coming back, no matter how you feel tonight. Just keep coming back till the good stuff happens, because the good stuff will happen. And you can't stop it from happening. Our lives get better in spite of our best efforts. If you just keep coming back and hang around. On the other hand, if you decide AA is not for you, there's not much guesswork either. Our lives, people who go back to drinking, their lives just get worse. And it's something that can't be stopped. It was the story of my life. I'd also like to say, Clancy isn't here, I know that. He told me, said, John, you're the only person I would entrust this group to while I'm gone. So, I'm speaking with a little bit of authority tonight. But I just stated to the new people that our lives get worse. And in the beginning, I'd like to... What happened? It's the story of my drinking. I was... I'll get into it as quickly as I can, or skip over as much as I can. I was ordained a Catholic priest in 1945... And I can skip what went before that because I didn't have any drinking problems before that. I didn't have any drinking problems in 1945 either. I took a private pledge not to drink. And I had no intention of going through life without drinking. I just intended to get enough maturity so that I could drink without getting in trouble. Because my dad was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be like my dad. I renewed that pledge once, which means that I went 2 years without drinking. And at the end of 2 years, as a young man in a very busy parish in downtown Denver, I thought I had reached maturity. I actually thought I matured faster than other people. Because I thought other people had to live this life blow by blow, and I was getting it in great big chunks from people who came to see me, and I really did think I'm a little more mature than the rest, and I can drink. I began to drink with great moderation. I would not drink in public places. I would not drink any place except private homes and other rectories. I would not drink in front of my mother. She had nothing against alcohol for anybody but me. And she didn't want me to drink because she didn't want me to be like my dad. And that's the reason I took the pledge, that I didn't want to be like my dad. But from the day that I began to drink until I eventually got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the rest of my life was the story of the relentless progression of alcoholism. It was just like a steamroller. It just relentlessly progressed. But it progressed so slowly, in my case, that I didn't see it happening. I never connected alcohol with any of my problems. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1970. And at my third meeting, if you hold up your hand as a newcomer at that meeting, you're asked before the evening's over to go up and say something. I held up my hand. They asked me to go say something, and I said what I had to say. And the last thing I said before I sat down was, besides, I don't think that I'm an alcoholic. And years later, or not so many years later, but sometime later, I thought I really had to be insane not to think that I was an alcoholic, because every problem I had from the time I started to drink until I got sober was connected with alcohol. Somebody gave me a membership in a country club, and I thought that was a really nice gift. I really appreciated it. But when I wrote my fourth step, I was able to see that the country club was one of the turning points in my life as far as drinking was concerned. Although I'm certain it would have happened in some other way under different circumstances, the way it actually happened was that I would eat dinner at the country club and everybody around was having cocktails. And one day I said to myself, I can drink here. This is a private place. And I began to drink at the country club because it was a private place. And it was no time at all before I was saying to myself, it's all right to have a cocktail in a restaurant before dinner. Everybody does that. And I began to order a cocktail in a restaurant before dinner. And before long, I'm ordering two cocktails. I wanted to order three in due time, but I was very caught up in public opinion, and I thought everybody in the restaurant was looking at me, and I thought, if I order three, they're all going to say, you see that Catholic priest over there? Realize that's the third drink they brought to his table? And actually, people didn't even know I was in the restaurant, but I was certain that they not only knew I was there, but that they were counting my drinks. But I dealt with that by ordering doubles, because I didn't think they were measuring the quantity. I thought they were only counting the trips. But today I realize it was one of those very subtle demands that alcohol makes as it progresses in our lives. And it seemed so reasonable to me that I didn't even give it any thought. Some friends of mine taught me you can drink in the car. Now, I never knew you could drink in the car. And it was a real revelation to me that you could do this. It's kind of like discovering America in a sense. I just never knew that. And they made it absolutely simple. All you have to do is take your drink with you. And I began to take my drink with me. But some time before that, a long time before that, I had heard somebody say, if you'll stick to scotch and water in tall glasses with lots of ice, you will never become an alcoholic. And that was very good news to me, because I figured I'd never become an alcoholic. I'll just drink scotch and water in tall glasses with lots of ice. I won't become like my dad. But once I found out you can drink in the car, I had to get the paraphernalia that would accommodate that. And in no time at all, I had a tray that would hold a tall glass. It took a little while for these developments to take place, but before it was over, I had a wide-neck thermos for ice, which I kept in the back seat of the car. I had a narrow-neck thermos for water, which I kept in the front seat. I bought scotch and pints because they fit under the seat. And I would not go to the filling station without a drink. I would not go any place without a drink. And I, on the other hand, I drove all over this country drinking every mile of the way. I just always had a drink, always. And I wouldn't stop to mix a drink. That takes too long. I would just reach in the back seat for the thermos for ice and put it in, reach under the seat for the scotch, pour it in, reach on the seat for the thermos with water, stir it with my finger, keep driving. As I say, it takes too long to stop, and besides, if you're a good driver like I am, you can do this. I did hear, after I got sober, every alcoholic has his last drink. But some of us are around to talk about our last drinks. And I hope I'm talking about my last drink. Because I think to myself, just to have survived that life is a great blessing and maybe some kind of a miracle. Because drinking and driving, which was the biggest mix I had, ends in disaster for most people, especially when you drive as many miles as I drove, always drinking. A priest friend of mine that used to ski with me, and we'd drink all the way up to the ski slopes and all the way back, was driving five people home from a conference, hit a bridge, and all six people were killed, and the report was that he was going 100 miles an hour. And I thought to myself, although I was drinking at this time, that could have been me. And I think of it that much more today, that just to be able to be here and talk about what I hope is my last drink is a great blessing in my life. One day, I said to myself, your mother has to enter the 20th century sooner or later. So you might as well have a drink in front of her. I wouldn't think of drinking in front of her at home, so she'd think that I drank recreationally, but I would have a cocktail in a restaurant before dinner with her because I thought this is a drinking society. She has to be part of this society. And pretty soon I'm ordering two drinks in a restaurant in front of her. Pretty soon I'm saying to the waiter under my breath, make those doubles. Because I didn't think my mother knew the difference between a double and a single. Today I think she probably measured every dram of liquor she ever saw me drink. But it made good sense to me in those days that she didn't know the difference between a double and a single. But what I know today is more and more demands were being made on me by alcohol. But I never connected it. I'm not feeling so hot, and I'm not, my thinking seems to be muddled. But anyway, I started to say I'm extremely addictive. I get hooked on things easily. And one of the things I got hooked on was bridge. And I got to the point where somebody would say, there's a bridge tournament in Pittsburgh, I'd say, let's go. Bridge tournament in Chicago, let's go. And I don't know how many times I drove to Los Angeles to go to Bridge Week out here. Always drinking, all the way, and almost always driving to these tournaments. Well, it turns out that my mother liked to play bridge. And I was going to go to a bridge tournament in Albuquerque. She lived in Colorado Springs, and I called her one day and said, Ma, I'm going to a bridge tournament in Albuquerque. You want to go? She said, yeah, I'd love to. I said, okay, I'll pick you up. I fixed my drink in Denver that would get me to Colorado Springs. But I knew then that's the last drink I can have before we stop for something to eat. I wouldn't dare drink in the car in front of my mother, so I packed my scotch in the suitcase. I drank my drink that would get me to Colorado Springs, rinsed out my mouth with mouthwash, which I always carried with me because I always needed it, picked her up, and we headed south. Now, there's a town about 100 miles south of Colorado Springs called Wolfsonburg, and my car just kind of drove itself up to the liquor store in that town. I went in, bought a pint of scotch, a bag of ice, came out, put them on the floor of the car, got in the car, drove down to the nearest filling station, took my glass into the men's room, filled it with water, came out, opened the scotch, opened the ice, and mixed a drink right in front of my mother. And I know this is killing her. You know, my son is drinking in the car? I could feel genuinely bad about that. But my head was saying to me, if one of us has to suffer, it's just not going to be me. I've suffered from Colorado Springs to Walsenburg, and she's going to have to suffer from Walsenburg to Albuquerque. But when I wrote my fourth step, and this came up in the fourth step, I had to think to myself, you know, if somebody had accused me of having a problem with alcohol in those days, I wouldn't have wanted to have anything to do with what they were saying. They'd say, well, would you really treat your mother this way if you didn't have a problem with alcohol? That was bad news to me. I didn't want to hear it, and I would have shut those people up. Look, this is my mother. You take care of your mother, I'll take care of my mother. Because I didn't want anybody threatening my desire to drink, but I didn't realize that until I wrote my fourth step when I got sober many years later. And it began to enter my mind that I was going to lose my parish. I had a beautiful parish in the northeast corner of town. But it never occurred to me to quit drinking. I didn't connect my drinking with the fact that I was going to lose the parish. It was just as if the fates have ordained that you're going to lose this parish, John. There's nothing you can do about it. So hang on as long as you can hang on. And I hung on as long as I could hang on, but the moral deterioration set in, and in time the Archbishop had to do something about it. He called me in, said to me, Father Healy, what are these things I'm hearing about you? Well, I didn't know what he was hearing about me, so I didn't want to volunteer any information. And we just sparred. And all he did that time was slap my wrists. But a year later, he called me in, and the second time, he didn't waste any time. He said to me, I'm sending you away to a monastery in the middle of New Mexico, which was a penal institution for priests. It was a total disgrace to go to that place. I had known priests who went there. They came back, and they just lived the rest of their lives in the shadows. And I thought, that's the way it'll be with me. I'll go down there, and I'll come back, but I'll just be in the shadows the rest of my life. People will say, you know, that's Father Healy. He's been down at that monastery. Don't offer him a drink. And it sounded like a totally bleak existence to me. But I was not given any choices. I tried to get out of it. I tried to say something in my own defense. The Archbishop said, shut up. I don't want to hear any more of your bullshit. You are going. And that was a very clear message to me. I knew that I was going. But I got down there, and I don't think I was there a week, when my head said to me, I don't know how this is going to end. All I know for sure is that it's not going to have a happy ending. So hang on as long as you can hang on. And that's what I did. And the Archbishop really only sent me there for 2 weeks, but I was there for 18 months. And in the 18 months that I was there, I got in more trouble than I'd got in the previous 15 years. I just really got in some serious trouble when I was in that monastery. But I never connected it with alcohol. I used to kind of get mad that they seemed to pin everything on me that wasn't really my fault. But, of course, when I took my fourth step, I could see they pinned it on me because I was the instigator of all the trouble that I got into. I was almost never somebody that followed somebody else into trouble. I instigated the trouble. And at the end of 18 months, I was no longer welcome in Denver. So I had to get a priest friend of mine in Albuquerque to take me in. He took me in, but my disease had progressed. Albuquerque is a smaller town than Denver, and the big book says we were tornadoes that roared through the lives of people. I was just a bigger tornado in a smaller town. I just roared around Albuquerque, creating all kinds of scandal. And I began to get thrown in jail for plain drunk. And I would always be thrown in jail in the middle of the night. And I was always scheduled for the 6 a.m. Mass. So I had to call the pastor from jail and say, I won't be able to show up for the 6 o'clock Mass because I'm in jail. And that means you're going to have to take my Mass at 6. You're going to have to get somebody to take your Mass at 8. And I don't want to cause you too much trouble, but I sure hope you'll come get me out of here. And he always got me out. But my head was saying to me, this is not going to have a happy ending either. And there's nothing you can do about it, John. It's just that this is not going to work out. So hang on as long as you can hang on. And I hung on as long as I could hang on, but he bailed me out of jail one morning. And that afternoon he came to my room and said to me, when are you leaving? And there was a real finality about the way he said that. I thought, this is not arguable. I'm leaving. And I was scared. I was scared, first of all, about my eternal destiny. I thought, there goes heaven. Because if you can't make it as a priest, you're just never going to make it as a layman. I also loved the priesthood. I looked upon it as the pearl of great price, the treasure that's buried in the field. But I was not being given any option. It was, when are you leaving? And the other thing that scared me was I didn't know how to make a living. But there I was. And there was also a certain sense of relief. Now I can drink the way I want to. Now if I go into a bar and they say to me, what do you do? I'll say, I'm a waiter. I belong here. Because I thought waiters belonged in bars. But when I was a priest, I never went into a bar in a Roman collar. I always went in sport clothes. And if people said to me, what do you do? I wasn't about to say I'm the parish priest of Sacred Heart Parish. I'd say, I'm a writer. I wrote a few sermons. I figured that qualified me as a writer. And I also didn't want to tell lies. And I think that's not a lie. I am a writer. And besides, when you find out I'm the parish priest of Sacred Heart Parish, say to me, what's the idea telling me you're a writer? You're the parish priest of Sacred Heart Parish. I said, well, didn't tell you everything I do. As a matter of fact, I am the priest of Sacred Heart Parish, but I'm also a writer. Because I don't want them to think that I'm a liar. So there was relief, but it wasn't the end of my drink, and I kept going to be near the end of my talk, though. I didn't get sober yet. I came to California, and I had 5 more years of drinking. And I finally stumbled into Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I got here, everything, my attitude in all situations was, this is not going to have a happy ending. Hang on as long as you can hang on. But there's nothing you can do about it. It's going to end in trouble. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to hear a different message. The message was not hang on. The message was let go. And I was so used to hanging on that I didn't know what it meant to let go. I tried to figure it out, and I couldn't, and I said to my sponsor, by the way, my sponsor belongs to this group, and that gives me some legitimacy here also. But I said to my sponsor, what does that mean, let go and let God? I said, it's not even good English. Let go of what? Let God do what? My sponsor said to me, in your case, just any little thing. And even when he said that, I could not think of any little thing to let go of. I tried, but I couldn't think of any little thing to let go of. Eventually, in sobriety, I found some very non-threatening thing to let go of, and I let go of it, and it just worked out so beautifully that I said, well, I'll be darned. You know, I thought it was some kind of a coincidence that it worked out so beautifully. But the big book says that first we believe these are coincidences. Eventually we come to expect them. And it was a very, very slow process with me to let go of things. But today I expect, if I let go of it, it just works out beautifully. If I hang on to it, I got to live with it. I have to live with the results of the things I hang on to. And in retrospect, it seems to me that long time when I was drinking, God said to somebody or another, I got a lot of good things I'd like to give John if he'd ever let go of that bottle. But as long as he's holding on to that bottle, I can't give it to him. And I didn't let go of the bottle because I expected to get the good things. But I believe it today because I let go of the bottle and I began to get the good things. And my life has just been a smooth run from the first year I got sober. Every year has been better than the preceding year. I expect my life to get better, and it gets better. And I had to think, in my drinking years, I expected my life to get worse, and it got worse. And it got relentlessly worse, and I made massive efforts to keep it from getting worse, but it got worse anyway. And in sobriety, my life gets better the same way, and I make massive efforts to keep my life from getting better, but it gets better anyway, because it's just the reverse of the way it was when I got here. And I also looked over my life, and I'd like to put in a plug here for the fourth step. I think it's the most important thing I ever did in my life. It totally changed my perspective on almost everything I do and almost everything I'm involved in. But one of the things I was able to see after I got sober that I couldn't see beforehand was that whenever there was a choice to be made in my life between alcohol and anything else, no matter how valuable, there was never a contest, ever. I did not want to lose that parish in Denver. But if I have to give up the parish or I have to give up booze, I guess I'll have to give up the parish because I'm not giving up booze. And I didn't like the situation in the monastery, but they tried to keep me from drinking, and my head said, they're not going to stop me from drinking. And they didn't stop me from drinking. And then I hated to lose the situation in Albuquerque. I hated to lose the priesthood. To me, as I said earlier, it was the pearl of great price, but if I have to give up the priesthood or give up booze, I guess I'll have to give up the priesthood because I'm not giving up booze. And the final thing was I sure hate not to go to heaven, but if I got to give up heaven or booze, I guess I'll have to give up heaven because I'm not giving up booze. Now, I never realized any of that, but that's the way I lived. I will hold on to booze till the very end, and I think it's some kind of a miracle that I ended up sober. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a hard nut to crack. And my own sponsor said to me, I have grave doubts that you will make this program. And I said to him, why shouldn't I make the program? I was going to meetings. I was doing externally what it seemed to me everybody else was doing. He said to me, because you refuse to surrender. And I said to him, what does that mean, surrender? I couldn't figure it out. I knew what the word surrender means, but it sounded to me like he was asking me to surrender to the air. And it just didn't make sense. He said to me, I can't tell you what surrender is. All I can tell you is, you better surrender. And he knew I had a higher power. He said to me, I suggest you ask your higher power to help you surrender. And that night, I went home and I said, God, if I have to surrender to make this program, I ask you to help me surrender. Nothing happened. I didn't think anything would happen, and it didn't. But sometime later, and I don't know how much later, one night I was reading the big book, and I said to myself, things are different. I don't know what's different. It's just that something is different. And I said, I wonder if this is what they mean, surrender. But I didn't know what surrender was. I didn't know what I was looking for. So I just had to speculate, maybe this is surrender. But the next day, I was driving to work, and I always had a pain across my shoulders in those days. Always. It was always there. It was complicated at that particular time by a stiff neck. And I'm driving down the freeway with my... I had to use the mirrors to drive because I couldn't turn my neck on my shoulders. And this pain began to go away. Just went down my back and kind of out the base of my spine. And I said to myself, this is surrender. I know it's surrender. And it wasn't because the pain went away that I knew it was surrender. Although the pain went away and that was very significant. But that morning on the freeway, I said, God, you can run this show. I don't care what happens. And I had never said anything like that in my life. Later I said, you would think as a priest somewhere along the line, I would have said, God, you can run this show. But I never did, because my head never told me to tell God to run the show. My head told me that God wanted me to get in there and sweat and strain and suffer like there are two horses pulling a cart, and he's saying, John, you're not pulling your share of the load. Get in there and work and struggle and pull your share of the load. That seemed to me quite the opposite from surrender. But that morning, I just said, I don't care what happens. I also realized that at an earlier time in my life, I had said something almost the equivalent of that. I had said, God, you can run this show provided I get this and that and this and that, and as long as I was getting what I wanted, God was doing a good job. But where God was not doing a good job, I said, I'll take care of this. I'll handle this. And it seemed to me in sobriety along the line, because I was always handling things and not letting go of them, it seemed to me one day God says, there are just too many hands in this stew here. Do you want me to run it, or do you want to run it? And sometimes I have to make those decisions. Well, I'll run it. He said, that's okay. I just want to know who's running it. I said, okay. Well, I'll run this part. And I run it. And I get a little uncomfortable. Seems to me God says, you getting uncomfortable? Yes. You want some help? No. It's okay. Well, just asking, that's all. Well, you got your answer. And pretty soon, I get so miserable that it seems to me God comes along and says, you miserable? Yes, I'm miserable. Do you want help? No, I don't want help. When I get miserable enough, I just throw it all up and say, take it. And then it just works out so smoothly that I have a hard time believing it. I say to myself, I could have done that months ago. But the reality is, I guess I couldn't have done it months ago. I had to get to a certain point where I would do it. But this is just a couple of the unbelievable fringe benefits of sobriety. I would say, in my case, one of the most important things is my own relationship with God. I have become very comfortable with God. But it was a process of becoming comfortable with myself. I never realized that. As long as I made impossible demands on myself, I had to be mad at myself because I was endlessly falling short. In sobriety, and I'm not recommending this, I'm just telling you what it was with me. I lowered my ideals. I did not raise my behavior. I lowered my ideals, and I began to accept myself the way I am. And as I began to accept myself the way I am, I got more comfortable. It seemed to me also, and I have these kind of, my sponsor said to me, you seem to have a direct line to God. Well, I talk to one side of my brain to the other, but one side is called God. And it seems to me that God said to me one day, John, I'm not mad at you. And I said, you're not? No, not mad at you. Well, you should be. Well, maybe I should be, but I'm not. How come? I'm just not mad at you, that's all. If you want to get mad at yourself and go out and self-destruct, that's okay. I love you just as much if you go self-destruct. I'm not mad at you. And then another time it seemed to me, God says to me, John, your sins do not impress me that much. And I had to think to myself, my sins impress me a great deal. But if they don't impress God that much, I wonder why they should impress me that much. And in the process, I would say, I became comfortable with myself, and I realized I always drank to get comfortable with myself. Thanks a lot.